What does it mean to you to bear witness?
It means to me to be able to take myself away from the scene, to take myself, set myself aside from what I'm looking at and accept what I'm seeing, to allow it to come to me, to allow it to be able to see what I'm seeing, but also feel what I'm seeing. And I think part of being a witness is also being able to talk about it. So taking it in, seeing it, and having that moment, but then also to be able to relay it back.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Indigenous Daughter of the West, C. Marie Furman, about her nonfiction and work as co-editor of the anthology Native Voices. This program was recorded in Spokane, Washington, during their Get Lit Literary Festival, with a generous support from Spokane Public Radio. Don't go away.
In the piece Aspen that was published in High Desert Journal, you circle around this movement of being witness, and I was hoping you would just start off by reading the first section of that piece.
Sure, thank you. The canted light falls on the aspen that line the road. Spotted black and white like palomino hides, the trees quiver with the anticipation of wild horses and watched with eyes fixed deep in their smooth bark. I am standing in the middle of Boydston Street, in the mountain town of McCall, Idaho. It's a back road into town, frequented mostly by locals. Caleb, my partner of 6 years, is kneeling before me. We are dressed up. We have just left a wedding. It had been a warm day, but it is cooling off quickly. I wrap my jean jacket around me and bury my hands in the pockets. I feel the uneven, rocky surface of the asphalt through the thin leather soles of my boots and shift my weight. I wonder if I should call the police. I do not have a gun, but my fingers worry the handle of the knife I'd placed in my pocket. I thought it was a dog, the man says as he runs his fingers through his salt and pepper hair. I do not look at him because I am angry at him, because I fear what I might say to him. I look instead at the fawn that lies at my feet. I hardly felt it. There are just the four of us, the man, Caleb, myself, and the fawn. The road is quiet. We are standing on the faded center line. The fawn's eyes are huge, black, glossy, blinking rapidly. Pain and fear hold her rigid. She pants and bleats softly at the aspen, but there is no reply. She will not live. She cannot survive. I feel this knowledge as pain in my chest, and I bend to stroke the soft fur of her small, pricked ears. Caleb slides his long arms beneath the fawn's tiny body. She looks like a toddler being carried to bed. She turns her head, looking again toward the aspen. She does not struggle. He carries her to the graveled side of the road, away from further harm by cars. Caleb is a tall man, over 6'4", a fisheries biologist, who hikes hundreds of miles in the wilderness each year. He can carry 10-foot rounds of dead larch to our pickup for firewood and can pack out all four quarters of an animal. And yet, when he bends to his work with juvenile salmon or kneels to rub the soft fur of our older dog's ears, there's a gentleness that belies his physique. The sun falls below the mountains now, the only light that of our taillights, which holds the scene in an unnatural carmine. Still, no one drives by. We will not leave the fawn to die alone, nor expect her to live. We are both sensitive to this kind of scene, guilty even when not complicit. Unable to watch another being suffer. It is a decision made before she was hit, a self-imposed ethic, a ritual enacted before. In my pocket, I feel the weight of the knife. It knows its dark purpose. In the cold and strength of that steel, I remember the blood of the doe it was used to kill 11 years earlier.
In the piece, you introduce to me, which seems like a kind of mundane experience, of a deer collision with a car. But you braid together these themes of death and sacrifice and witness and partnership. And I wanted to know when the moment as a writer you knew, you know, that moment of synergy where you knew this was the story and these were the braids that you were going to bring together.
That story was about the knife. It came out of an idea that Kim Barnes had given me to write about, just about a knife. And she's like, just think of a knife in your life and write about it. And of course, that immediately came to mind was this pocket knife that my father had given me. And originally it was meant for things like gutting fish and ranch work. And that knife had traveled so much with me in that moment when my late husband had used it to kill another deer. So I knew that when I was thinking about how to tell that story, as painful as the story is, particularly the part of losing my husband in an accident, that I could put that emotion and that energy into that knife and into the deer and bring those two together in a way that wasn't about me as much, if that makes sense, but really was able to put the emotion into the things, into the animal. And when I was finished, I realized that it was also a larger narrative of the West, really, and that vulnerability of the deer, the guns, the knives, this kind of moving forward, and how those things keep colliding, especially with how we're trying to redefine the West now. So it became a much larger story when I realized what all was packed into the deer and the knife and the road and everything there.
I'm glad you brought up the knife, because I was so curious to you both about the object symbolism of the knife and also the reality of what it means as a hunter, as a woman who also has hunted. Can you talk a little bit about both the symbolism and just the literal, again, knife, mm-hmm. what it means to you to have that, carry that on the land?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I'll answer the literal part on the land first. I was just speaking to someone. I was hiking in Idaho down by Rapid River, which is kind of near the town of Riggins, and also near where I shot a cow elk in December. I was talking about how it changes when hunting season comes along, my traditional hunting season, and now I'm carrying a gun or I'm carrying some sort of weapon. The intention has shifted greatly. And my partner and I spend most of the summer out in the wilderness, out in the forest. And when we're there in the summer, we carry no weapons. We might have a knife for utilitarian purposes, but never as something for defense or for harm. So when we step out to hunt, that feeling changes. And I almost don't like myself as much anymore, because I'm not this person that's there just to observe or to be one with this place. I've changed kind of my role there. And it's a little bit different. I have to like reexamine who I am in that place. And so that particular knife that I do take with me when we hunt and that I do use to gut and skin animals has a deep history to it, and it has a dark job. And I think that knife then can also be seen as the writer that will have a deep history imbued in a place, particularly for Native writers. I'm thinking of Native writers now, or for people who have been in the West a long time. And sometimes that job that we have to do that is often uncomfortable, you know, when we're, whether it's killing a deer to put it out of its pain or to open it up, it's kind of that pin that we use too, to open up stories, to open up wounds that need to be reopened and to be able to heal them properly. So I think that the knife serves that kind of metaphorical purpose as well.
In talking about killing or putting the fawn out of its misery, what is our ethical responsibility to other life?
I think that there's something about starting or finishing what we've started. When in the first scene with, or the second scene with my late husband and I, when we watched that deer get hit, and I think we see that a lot. I don't see it as much in the mountain town of McCall, Idaho, where I live now, nor out here as I did in Montana, in that area. But to leave something struggling, to leave something dying without either bearing witness to that death or sitting with that death to just drive off from it and pretend it didn't happen, we're not doing our civic responsibility, and we're not doing our human responsibility, not just to that life, but to this place that holds us. And in many ways, and I can't help but draw the cultural reference to what has happened to Native people too, that just going by on the side of the road, the progress, you know, in a vehicle hitting a deer, I've got to get to where I'm going. I can't stop to deal with this life, or I can't physically, like the man in that first scene ends up leaving because as soon as the knife comes out, he just can't bear to finish what he started or see it all the way through. So I think that we have some responsibility to life as well as to death. Part of the reason we hunt too, because we want to have the responsibility for killing what we eat and giving it that honor and the time that we spend with it rather than something that's just been caged or kept up. So
I'm so struck by this notion of the collision of settlement and Indigenous life. Mm-hmm. What would it look like for us to stop and hold that experience? I mean, how can we do that?
I think there are so many ways to do that. I got to spend some time with some strong Native women today, most of my morning with that, and we talked about how maybe one or two Native writers is brought to the forefront, and everyone's like, wow, we just wish there was more work out there, and there is. It's just that we're tending to look at just one or two examples instead of, like you said, to stop and look around and see what life is around us and what writing is around us and what Indigenous peoples, Native people in the center of Indian country here are going through. And there's ample opportunity to do that. And I don't know if that means that non-Native people feel like they need an invitation or that they're being locked out or they're just not choosing to see a part of the West that they want to feel is either dead or has moved on and not been kept in this kind of romantic Indian ideal. So when they really have to look at the poverty or they have to look at the success of Native people, I'm thinking of Paulette Jordan here, who's a great example of one of our Native women that has chosen to take on greater and greater responsibility. I think that that's also sometimes hard for non-Native people to stop and look at. So, you know, making sure to stop at those moments, whether they're cultural moments or whether they're just human moments, and pay attention is important. And not just drive through the reservation, just like you would drive by what you might call an accident, not you yourself, but what someone might call an accident.
I can't wait to talk more in depth about your work as a co-editor of the book Native Voices. But I'm desperate to talk about the point in your piece where you address your late husband, because it's sort of a short passage. And maybe you've already said this, but I wanted to know how did you look that place in the eye, and how did you hold the heat of it? I mean, what part of what you said is, you know, you diverted it into the knife, but just as a writer, what was that process like?
So I really wanted to keep this story not about me. And even though it is, the focus tends more towards the deer in particular, and at one point Caleb, and then also at my late husband. But I knew if I dwelled upon the moment of Randy's death, that the whole story could fall in right there. And it could open so many doors, and people would want to walk through the different doors and want to know, well, how exactly did it happen? And then what did you do next? And if I was just able to be very subtle about that and put all of that pain back into those two animals, my pain in particular, then the effect, even though it's one or two sentences, would be as jolting as if the whole story were about it. So in that case, I felt like that whole tip of the iceberg, it had to be just subtle enough that it hurt, that it was a pinch, but got us kind of back onto the story or back onto the road. Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with poet, nonfiction writer, and Native Voices co-editor, C. Marie Furman. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page.
You're also the co-editor with Dean Rader of the book Native Voices, Indigenous American Poetry, Craft, and Conversations. And the book press says, Native poems, stories, and essays are informed with a knowledge of both what has been lost and what has been restored. It is a celebration of culture and the possibilities of language. At the risk of sounding ignorant, can you name the losing?
The losing is an identity. The losing is an entire people, an entire culture, and it's the knowing of the place that we're in, which we've already lost so much of already. We've come to the what we call now the United States, this place with science and with these ideas that have been here for thousands of years before, and we lost all of that by silencing a people and by not listening to their stories, which are regarded as myth instead of as proof of being. So that loss, that bleeding has to be stopped. That wound has to be cauterized before we lose any more of that and before we lose any more of an American identity, which I think that Native people will always have to be a part of and need to be a part of now more than ever.
How do you hope that this book will cultivate that restoration then?
You know, I talk about this a little bit in the preface that Dean and I wrote. There's a painting in a cave in Hell's Canyon. It's called Redfish Cave. And it's of this salmon, this red salmon in ochre paint. And it's back in kind of the twilight room of the cave. And it's behind an iron gate that the Forest Service has put over to protect it. And to protect the formations that are in that cave. And it's the last remaining salmon above Hell's Canyon Dam. So when they put the four dams in Hell's Canyon, at the last one they realized, well, we're just failed at fish passage, so we're not even going to bother to try. So 12,000 salmon died in a single day when those dams were built, and none have gone up there since. And I think of that so much as a metaphor for what has happened to Native people, but I also think of that fish all the time and think of the artist and how at some point that artist was inspired to go to the cave and to make that painting and who took it in and in some fashion felt like they wanted to leave this remnant of what they were feeling or what they cherished there for others. I think that this book, because it includes the craft essays, is also creating this collection of voices that get to talk about their art. We often like to theorize about why the art's there. What is that fish about? What is it symbolizing? You know, is it a tribal marker? Is it something sacred? Was there ceremony? And that's important too, right? But what's also important is considering it that there was an artist. And what was that artist like? And so So Native Voices was a chance not only to collect these poems, which are unbelievable, beautiful, and worthy by themselves, but to give the artists a chance to talk about their art, to be seen as both artists and art, and to be seen as poets, not Native poets. And I don't want to say just Native because there is not just in there, but as poets themselves and as equal to anyone else that's writing poetry. So it was that chance to kind of collect in one book this whole lineage of poetry. So there are also ancestor texts in there. They get a chance to talk about poems that influenced them, which sometimes are Native, sometimes are creation stories, and sometimes are from non-Native writers, and be able to pay homage there and to celebrate that poem, but also talk about their process in ways that maybe they're trying to decolonize poetry or use the master's tools to themselves kind of write new poetry.
That's right. I read in an interview with Write in Idaho, you talk about that importance of dialogue and not just the content. And so I wanted to hear from you. Talk about your identity as an artist, as a poet, and also about your process.
Gosh, that's, I think that my identity as a poet and writer comes from the place in which I'm situated or the places in which I'm situated. I write so much about place, so much about Idaho, where I live, and so much about kind of these wild places, but I cannot forget where I come from, my heritage, which is also important to those places. I work in Indian education at the University of Idaho, and those two always meet in some way. So my identity is informed from both that Native side and working in Native education, but also through my love of the outdoors and love of place, and also the need to see place as is something that's also in danger right now and vulnerable, and certainly trying not to create a Jeremiah idea of nature to see as something that we still can save. And maybe that just comes from a resilience of being Native as well. Mm-hmm.
Will you talk about the program that you run?
Yeah, so I am a project coordinator for IKEEP, Indigenous Knowledge for Effective Education Program. It is a Department of Education grant through the Office of Indian Ed that allows us to fund anywhere from 8 to 12 scholars who are Native, who want to become teachers and teach back in tribal schools or schools serving a higher than average Native population. So we're able to fund their schooling through the degree and through their certificate, and also give them 2 years of induction so they can get very situated within the school. And the most important aspect of this is that on top of their regular curriculum that they get through the University of Idaho, we offer classes with Indigenous pedagogy and Native ways of knowing, so that when they come to form their curriculum for their students, they're doing it through our ways of knowing, through Native ways of knowing that's culturally responsive and not colonial. So we found that our students, particularly students growing up on the reservation or in tribal communities, don't learn maybe necessarily the way a group of suburban, upper middle class students might learn. And so those texts and those curricula that are made for those students don't always translate as well. So we lose a lot of our students. They drop out of school or they just don't continue. And it's not because they can't keep up or they're not smart enough. It's because the curricula doesn't make sense to them and it doesn't fit their ways of knowing. So our teachers are becoming informed in this, and they're able to bring in their ways of knowing and doing and learning, and then they take it back to these communities and teach through that way.
It's incredible.
Yeah, we're so excited. We have our first cohort graduating in May, so we're excited to see them get in the schools and make the change we know that they'll make.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
In terms of colonialism, you moderated a panel at the Montana Book Festival called Decolonizing Mythologies of the West, Rewriting Cowboys and Indians, and it was the most attended panel at the festival. What is it you think people are hungry to understand or revise about these mythologies?
I think that people are beginning to recognize that the stories that we have told for the last almost 100 years, at least 80 years, are about a period of time in Western history that was very short, when cowboys and Indians conflicted. And there was the idea of this romanticized period, which wasn't really very romantic for either the cowboy nor the Indian, but it's put us in a place. So I always think of it as like a cat being held by the tail who's trying to run away and scraping at the floor but can't get away. And writers are doing it. Media is doing it. Society in general is doing it when we try to say, if you're going to be an Indian, you have to look a certain way, or you have to be a certain way, or if you're going to write an Indian, it has to be, if they're not doing, if they're not in feathers or beads, or if they're not wise and sage-like, then it's not really true. And if it's a cowboy and they're not tough and never cry, John Wayne-like or stoic, that they're not true. So what we wanted to do on that panel was have a chance to say, and all of the writers on that were doing work to kind of decolonize that idea, to demythologize and look at cowboys who were also vulnerable and weak and caring and all of the opposite of this John Wayne tough guy, and look at the true historic relationship between cowboys and Indians, which was often quite strong. They were often very understanding of one another and not always shooting each other up and living out these fantasies that were just created by media and by writers and by society. So that panel was a chance for writers to ask other writers and readers to ask other writers different ways that they could help redefine Western writing. And that, in turn, helps the West form a new identity, an identity that's going to evolve to where we need it to be if we're all going to make it here. So to look at where Native people are now, we are still here. We're not held in the past by the tale. And the same with people who are working the land in Montana who are seen as cowboys or who are just men living in the West. How can they be accepted as what they do and not expected to be these stoic, unfeeling human beings? So it was really fun to have like the three Western kind of genre male writers with these three Native women to talk about the different ways in which we're trying to all work against that.
You call yourself an Indigenous daughter of the West. And what does that term mean to you?
I feel like I'm more than just my tribal relation. I'm more than just an ethnic identifier. So I always felt that fit better because I'm just as much mountain as I am Southern Ute. I'm just as much pine tree as I am Four Corners. So to me, I just feel like I've been parented, I've been raised by the place as well as, and I think this goes back to your identity question, so much of Native culture, Native belief, Native wisdom is in me. At the same time, so much of mountain stream and pine needles and elk bugling and wolves is also in me. So I like to think that that's what has come forth is a product of that, not just a product of one singular identity. And so I feel like that works well to explain that.
C. Marie Furman's poetry and nonfiction have been published widely. She is the project coordinator for the Indigenous Knowledge for Effective Education program at the University of Idaho. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.